Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report, chatting with Jesse Felder, going to be focusing on the broad averages and why he sees some more market weakness, maybe even a much larger bear market here forming for the broad averages, pointing to a number of different internal factors and different data points that he is watching. Jesse is the founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, big question when it comes to the U.S. equity markets. After a very strong run in the fourth quarter of last year and even into pretty much the first quarter of this year up until March, the markets were ripping higher. We've seen a bit of a rollover here. They're off their highs. They've lost their momentum to the upside. One of the reasons we've been hearing is that, look, investors are just realizing that this is more the higher for longer in terms of rate narrative because of the fact that the Fed won't be cutting seven times that the market had priced in last year or even possibly three times that the Fed's telling us now. Jesse, do you think that is the only reason why markets have been weak now?
I think it's half the reason. I think, you know, the higher for longer narrative has just come about as a function of stickier inflation than, markets had anticipated this year, right? We've had super core CPI. Jay Powell has pointed to as being kind of a what you would look at if you're worried about a wage price spiral has come in super hot last couple of months. I mean, I think the 3-month annualized rate is over 5-6% or something. So those kinds of things point to much stickier, a much bigger inflation problem than markets had appreciated. And so we had, over the last, 6 or 9 months, really off the rally off the October lows has been driven by this idea of a soft landing or even a no landing in the economy. If interest rates have to stay higher for longer because of stickier inflation, that doesn't allow the Fed to cut interest rates in the way, market participants had come to discount. But it also suggests, I think, that the economy could potentially be weaker than a no landing narrative would allow for. And when you look at some of the kind of leading indicators of the labor, the health of the labor market, a lot of these things are pointing to a significantly weakening labor market. If you look at S&P, recent S&P services reading that came out this week, it showed the biggest drop since the COVID closure of the economy. And outside of that, it was the biggest drop since 2009. So services businesses are potentially really backing off of hiring. And so if you have both sides of this no landing narrative, which is inflation is going to be hotter and economic growth is going to be weaker, stocks are not priced at all for us for a stagflation narrative. And I think that's probably more likely what we're headed for.
Well, Jesse, let's dive into that idea a little bit further. We've talked about stagflation before on the show and even with you that, if the economy started slowing but inflation remained stickier and the labor markets started showing some cracks under the surface, the market's not really prepared for that. We were talking about even in the market, some of the market internals starting to show weakness again, where things were, the breath was starting to spread out. It started to narrow again. And you mentioned you've got this concept, the 350s that you've been looking at for the market internals. I'd love you to share that as far as under the surface of the markets, what you see.
Yeah, it's, the 350s are three different indicators that I watch, pretty closely. The one I think you're referencing is related to the breadth in the market. So, two signals that I've been watching for years now are the Hindenburg omen and the Titanic syndrome. And essentially, both of these are really scary sounding. They're triggered on a daily basis, on a daily time frame. But it's, when they trigger once, it's not really something to worry about. And essentially, what triggers them is when you have a stock market index near a new high, a new 52-week high, but the number of new lows on the index is rising above a certain threshold, is basically what triggers these two types of indicators. And so a healthy market that's hitting new highs shouldn't see a lot of its constituents making new 52-week lows. So when you see this kind of thing, it's exactly the type of dispersion or breadth warning that you should pay close attention to. So when you see a number of these Titanic syndromes or Hindenburg omens triggered over a certain window, then when you can start to kind of say, okay, we really have a problem with breadth. Over the last 12 months, we've seen more than 50 Titanic syndromes triggered across the New York Stock Exchange, and mostly on the NASDAQ NASDAQ composite. And whenever you've seen 50 trigger over a 12-month period, it's been a very clear breath warning that the market uptrend is far weaker under the surface than it would appear. The other two 50s and indicators that I'm watching are one we talked about last time a month ago, was the insider selling to buying ratio in terms of the dollar amounts. Over a 13-week look-back period, we've seen that ratio of sell to buy cross above 50. And that's the highest reading I've ever seen. And so insiders are selling like there's no tomorrow. That's a really good leading indicator, typically, 12 to 24-month leading indicator of what the economy and corporate earnings are going to do. And so insiders have not really been this bearish on the economy and on earnings, in at least a decade. So then the third one is the Magnificent Seven stocks. When you aggregate their market caps and their free cash flow, they trade at as a group more than 50 times free cash flow, which is an extreme, obscene valuation, really. I mean, you could argue they maybe should trade 25, 30 times, but even if that's the case, then, that requires a 40% decline in the stock prices to get them back to kind of a reasonable valuation. The other flip side of that, the reason why they become so expensive is because their CapEx is going through the roof. It's really, really costly to build out these large language models, and build out the server farms and things that are required to kind of build these AI models. It's just very, very costly, and it's eating into cash flow in a big way. So I think when you put all these things together, extreme valuations, insider selling that's off the charts, and really extreme breath warnings, it points to a much more significant decline in the stock market than a no landing or even a soft landing narrative would allow for.
So what are you looking for in terms of U.S. market moves here? Where could, let's say, the S&P or the Dow, where could it pull back? How much percent are we looking at? Is this a maybe rest of the year story, continued weakness in the markets?
Well, personally, I believe a major bear market started in 2022 and it hasn't ended. If you look at under the surface, obviously, right, S&P 500 has overcome that 2021 peak. So has NASDAQ. But the Russell 2000 hasn't. And if you look at basically the average stock, we've been in a sideways movement essentially now for 2.5 years, almost 3 years. And to me, that's more characteristic of bear market type activity. I think we're probably just in the first couple of years of a very long-term bear market. That's, another lost decade is probably what we should expect, just because valuations became so extreme. And the environment, from a macro perspective, the environment is really not conducive to owning financial assets. If inflation is going to stay, above its trend for the previous years, it's going to be much more conducive to owning real assets, another theme that we've talked about for a long time. So I think what's driven us off of the October low over the last, 6, 7, 8 months has been this AI narrative. I think the AI hype is now giving way to a reality that there's not going to be a lot of earnings. I think I read something that, out of the $30 or $50 billion of spending that we've seen on AI over the last 12 months, the companies behind it have generated less than $2 billion in revenue so far. So this is a problem that if the AI hype, which is that, this is going to create a productivity miracle and it's going to sustain cash flows for these companies for years to come, if that doesn't materialize really quickly, we're going to have a problem. We're going to start to see it this earnings season with Meta announcing tonight and some, Alphabet and Microsoft. If these companies cannot start monetizing this on relatively short order, the amount of spending, CapEx, that's going into it could start to put investors on edge.
Yeah, Jesse, it's one thing to announce AI in your company and that you're investing into it. It's another thing to show a profit from it and that it's actually benefiting the bottom line of the business. It does take time, but you brought up the earnings season. There's also a lot of people discussing what the trends may be on the earnings seasons this year compared to last year. And we just had kind of a shot across the bow with UPS. We were making note of that before the call started, just that they had a weaker than expected earnings report. And a lot of people made that a meme over this last week and saying, I guess nobody's shipping packages in this robust economy. And they were kind of ripping on it, but it may speak to maybe just the earnings season not being as robust as people expected. And you said this kind of ties into the Dow theory and some of the divergences seen there. So maybe speak to that, the differences in the transports versus the industrials.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's something that I have continued to watch for years and years. I'm a big fan of Richard Russell's work. I read his stuff for many years. And, you know, he was really the expert on the Dow theory. And the Dow theory is pretty simple, you know, created by Charles Dow 100 years ago or something, that the industrials, if one of the two indexes, the industrials or the transports, makes a new high, it needs to be confirmed by the other in order to send a bullish message or confirm a bullish message about the economy. It's really an economic indicator. And what we've seen is the industrials made a new high this year, and the transports have failed to confirm that high for many months. And so that's a very important Dow theory non-confirmation that suggests, you know, that was basically flying in the face of the soft landing narrative. Everybody who was pushing the soft landing or no landing narrative should have been hoping to see the transports make a new high to kind of really confirm that and see the market confirm their thesis. And now the fact that it hasn't was a really, really important, I think, warning in that regard. And UPS is just the latest, I think, in confirmation of that Dow theory non-confirmation, which is, as I said, is as much an economic warning as it is a breath warning for the market.
So, Jesse, you mentioned that, look, you're looking at hard assets as the investment angle to play this broad weakness here. And we have seen some money, a fair bit of money, rotate into a wide range of different commodities. But how does that fit into the narrative of economic weakness, especially when you're looking at something like oil or copper, which can be, usually are, barometers of economic strength if they're moving higher? How do you balance that out?
Yeah, you know, the oil price, it's very interesting. The oil price typically discounts a recession before the recession actually begins. And by the time a recession is identified or it's clear to the world that, you know, the recession is starting, the oil price has already started to turn higher. And so, and that's because what the oil price is starting to do at that point is discount the stimulus and things that are coming, as you know, typically see, you know, the authorities engage in countercyclical kind of stimulus. So I think, you know, that might be one of the things that we're seeing. But also, I have to say, you know, one of the things we've talked about commodities, I think, over the last few months, too, is that they're much more sensitive to what the Chinese economy is doing. And I think I've said for a few months now, if the Chinese economy starts to, you know, if they start to get their act together, then commodities are going to respond. And I think that's what we've seen with the copper price. I think it's what we've seen in oil. And you know, some of it, people talk about, you know, geopolitical stuff with oil. And of course, that's a driver too. But there's a reason copper prices have been so strong. And I think that's because the Chinese economy is starting to show signs of finally turning and becoming more positive. And if that's the case, you know, then a recession here in the U.S. is not going to dent demand in the way that, you know, would make people super bearish or make, you know, drive a major oil price decline. The other thing that I would point out, too, is that when people think of recession, I think we talked about this last time again, they think about the great financial crisis. They think about a deflationary bust that, you know, threatens a Great Depression. What we saw in the 1970s was very different. We saw nominal growth continue to grow at, you know, high single digits through the recession. But inflation obviously rose faster than nominal GDP growth. And so you had a net negative real growth. I think that's could be a much better, analog for what we should expect the economy if we have, you know, if we do see another recession this year, is nominal growth could remain relatively strong while inflation picks back up again. And so you have a totally different type of recession where it's not driven by, you know, a deflationary bust, which is kind of, you know, due to recency bias, what people think about a recession. They think about, you know, the COVID lockdowns, and they think about the financial crisis. So if we don't, if we can have a recession that is a totally different, has a totally different character than those, where demand for commodities remains relatively strong. And so I think that, you know, we might have seen the oil price and commodities already discount the slowdown that has just now started to materialize in the economy.
I think it's an interesting point, Jesse, because a lot of people think in their minds, if it's a recession, we're not going to have any growth. But if we still had growth, but it was just outpaced by inflation, that plays right into the hard assets in the commodity sector. And it's not just copper and oil that have been strong. If you look at zinc prices, they're the highest they've been in a year. If you look at aluminum prices, they're the highest they've been since January of 2023. And some people are not just attributing that to U.S. growth or China getting back on the map again. But there's also the sanctions that the UK has placed and that the Eurozone has placed on Russia exports of their metals. And Russia is a major player for things like aluminum and tin and palladium and nickel and all these other assets. So we've seen a spike in a lot of the hard assets and metals, and we're even seeing it in soft commodities. Is there maybe just a global focus now to move out of paper assets and into more hard assets?
I think that's, you know, it's a a corollary of the trend towards deglobalization, right? We've been seeing this. I mean, one of the I think we're realizing the big mistakes that we made as a nation over the last 40 years was hollowing out our manufacturing ability, offshoring labor and production and outsourcing everything. And I think it was a great article I read in The Atlantic this week that Boeing is maybe the perfect example of this, is that, you know, all of the problems at Boeing are the result of them abandoning their manufacturing culture and literally, you know, being totally out of control in how they manage their manufacturing quality and all these types of things. And now we're realizing the risks that this poses when, you know, the people who do all of our manufacturing are not necessarily our allies any longer in terms of, you know, military ambitions. And so, you know, we're there's a huge push now to reshore all of this production, and it's extremely difficult, right? We're seeing that with Taiwan Semiconductor building their new plant manufacturing facility in Arizona. It's taking way longer than anticipated, and you know, part of that is just the being able to train Americans to do what they do in Taiwan so well. But you can kind of extrapolate that to all sorts of industries and things, and it's going to be extremely costly. It's going to put a huge demand on infrastructure and on energy. It takes a lot of energy to do these things, and so this major shift from globalization to reshoring is something that's just undeniable now. I think Janet Yellen, there was a great quote Janet Yellen said that, you know, as an economist for years and years and years, she believed that if somebody were to say, well, we want to ship you cheap goods, you just say thank you and write them a thank you note. She said, never again will I ever think that way. And that's representative of the way that the U.S. and other, you know, major, you know, G7 nations around the world are starting to feel, is that, wait a second, there's the cost of cheap goods is too great, of hollowing out our manufacturing, being beholden to foreign powers for, you know, to build everything we need to run our economy, and also, you know, hollowing out the middle class in the process is just not politically feasible, let alone, you know, in terms of just being able to manage your economy. So I think this shift away from globalization towards something different, it puts such a huge demand on real things, on real assets, and it's going to be so costly and inflationary that the only thing to do is to focus your investments in areas that are going to benefit from that. And that's not financial assets, right? It's not stocks and bonds.
Yeah, this deglobalization aspect, that's the thing that really sticks with me, with the potential of inflation staying higher for longer, because that did seem to keep down, lower the cost of goods. So if you're looking at commodities and it's not financial assets or stocks, what about the commodity stocks? We've seen some of the base metal stocks do very well, and precious metal stocks are starting to get going, but they have broadly been laggards in the bigger picture here. So what's your play in terms of filtering down into the commodity stocks, and which ones could outperform?
Yeah, it's, for me, it's still just, energy and precious metals. It's the two themes that I've talked about for years now. I feel like I've talked about it till I'm blue in the face. But energy stocks are still dramatically underowned by institutions. They make up something like 10% of earnings of the S&P 500, but they're 3%, of the allocation of the S&P 500. They're about as cheap as they ever get, even still. And I think that, and it's the only area where I've seen over, consistent insider buying for several years now, really since the fall of 2020, when insiders just started pouring into this space. It's been really the only space that's had, net insider buying that I've watched for quite some time. So I think the energy space, all of this, like I said, is going to require energy. You want to build out AI, it's going to require massive investment in energy infrastructure, and probably, there was a great article on this topic too, that it's going to require coal, fired power plants that were scheduled to be, shut down. It's going to require those to keep operating. And that's going to put a huge incentive for people to say, okay, would we rather have coal, or would we rather build some natural gas fired plants to kind of power these things? And so, I think energy is really a no brainer. And then just from a monetary standpoint, from an inflation standpoint, it makes a ton of sense to talk about underinvested. The precious metals are dramatically underinvested by institutional, by retail, across the board. And I think Chinese investors are going nuts for gold right now, as they should be with what's going on in their economy. But eventually that's going to come, that same kind of investor sentiment is going to come west, and we're going to see U.S. investors. And we see it a little bit, things like demand for the Costco gold bars and things. But sentiment is still so depressed, and there's no interest in owning gold right now. And I think that's going to change. That's going to be a major change that happens over the next few years, where you start seeing Western investors start to think in the same way that Eastern investors are thinking about gold right now.
And that's what we need, right? Some more Western demand to drive some of these stocks, because there has been a lot of demand for gold as a metal out of the East. And it's just been that Western demand that's lacking that can actually drive these stocks higher. A lot of our listeners have been waiting for these stocks to move higher, and they have rebounded over the last 2 months. Still a lot of upside to go here. Jesse, thank you very much for your time. It's always very interesting to hear what underlying data you're looking at for these markets. We'll chat again next month. And just as a reminder, you want to follow along with Jesse, check out the Felder Report, which I will link to below. Jesse, thanks for your time, man. Have a great rest of your week.
You too, guys. Thanks for having me.